Hello, I'm Ron Van Dam, and I'm a talk show host. Yes, I am a talk show host. I'm one of the few chosen people who sit here and talk. Is it because I'm talented? Intuitive? No. It's because I can't do anything else. I don't touch things with my hands. I don't lift things. I don't repair things. I don't build things. I just talk. I remember the day I was sitting on a curb on a dirty street eating out of the garbage. Three wise men approached me, actually. Two were wise, one of them kind of stupid. They tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Tag, you're it." I said, "What is this foolish game that you play?" They said, "We are tagging you. You are going to be a talk show host." I said, "Why me?" They said, "Because you possess a quality that others don't have." I said, "What is that?" So we don't know. But with your talent, you can influence, lead, advise, open people's hearts to the world around them. Being a talk show host is a great, great privilege. And we hand it to you, Ron. Run with it. Walk with it. Make it your own. You are a talk show host.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing. Whatever.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show. Guess which my I am, Ron? Yes. Stop it. How you doing, ladies and gentlemen? My name is Ron, and I am a talk show host. I do admit it. Sheepishly, but I do admit it. Hey, we got a great show today. A little bit later in the show, I'm going to be joined by James Carroll, a man with two first names. He's written a book called Christ Actually. Takes a look at the man himself and what happened during the crucifixion and how that whole thing is viewed. Of course, interesting to me because the Bible and all the writings were composed hundreds of years after his leaving the planet. So I don't know. Religion to me is wonderful on a personal level, horrifically horrible on a social level. Religion divides human beings. It puts us into groups. You're a Christian, you're a Catholic, you're a Jew, you're a Bech. And some of us wear it on our sleeves, wear it in jewelry, put bathtub Marys, I think you call them, in front of your house to show that you are, you know, you're into that Mary thing. I mean, We segregate ourselves. You go to your church, I go to my church, there's a church over here, that's a synagogue, that's a temple. It's segregating. It takes the humanity out of us. However, those that wish to be religious, it should be a personal thing. It should be a one-to-one thing with your soul, not, you know... I think religion is what causes 99.9% of wars. It causes hatred, causes violence. This thing that's supposed to make us so pious and so close to our deity and our and the goodness of our souls is the very faction that causes wars, because religion segregates us. We define ourselves by how we group ourselves. And that's the same with countries. I mean, yeah, there are countries and states and all that kinds of things, but it segregates us. United States is blessed by God. God bless America. England, not so much. God save the Queen. That's their song in England. I mean, what's God doing? Now God is deciding which countries to bless and which ones not to. We just take it way too far. I think the idea of this Bible thing, was to make individuals closer to some type of thing, some type of concept. I don't think it was supposed to be a gigantic group cult following, which I believe it has become. Or maybe it was the idea. I don't know. But religion is wonderful on a... that's a personal, that's in my soul kind of conversation. If someone says, what religion are you? The response should be, that's between me and my God. Let's talk about sports or about how to make a great hamburger, not about my relationship with my supreme being, not about my soul. We don't talk about that. That's my thing. And that's, I think that's the level it should stay on personally. But who am I? I'm nothing but a talk show host. Anyway, let me take a sip of my decaffeinated green tea. This is my new kick, ladies and gentlemen. I have searched the world to find a unsweetened green tea. No sugar. Sugar is bad for you. You can't drink sugar all day. So something unsweetened. Green tea is supposed to be wonderful for you. It's supposed to have antioxidants, and you're supposed to drink, if you drink green tea every day, you will live to be six years old. And after that, you're taking your chances. I can't do caffeinated stuff. If I had a half a cup of regular coffee, I'd be up for the next 17 years. A five-hour energy drink would turn into a 500-year energy drink. I can't do caffeine. Perhaps I'm not used to it. It makes me jittery. It makes me nervous. It makes me anxious. It ramps up my blood pressure. I don't think caffeine's good for anybody personally. So I've been combing the earth looking for decaffeinated green tea unsweetened, and I finally found it. And I bought a case of it, and now I am hooked on it like some type of heroin or something. A lot healthier than heroin, I must say. But I love it. I am hooked on this stuff. I put this green tea into everything that I drink now. That's fantastic. And I feel healthier. Maybe it's psychological. Doesn't matter if it's psychological or physical. Really doesn't matter. If it is, it is. If it is to me, then it is to you. Religion isn't physical. Religion is all in your head. It's all the concept. It's a concept you accept in your head. Why can't green tea be that way? So I found out. And by the way, don't start emailing me and stuff. Ron, where do you get the decaffeinated green tea unsweetened? My God, it's so hard to find. I'm not going to tell you. That's my secret. That's my religion, and I don't discuss it. So later on, we will be talking to James Carroll. Christ Actually is his book. Fascinating stuff. And we'll do that kind of soon. I mean, maybe a little sooner than you would like. Mm-hmm. Hey, I was watching sports yesterday. I was watching an NFL football game. I was watching the Patriots, that's football, play against the Colts, Indianapolis Colts. And the Patriots won because they always do. And I, you know, when I look at things, I don't just watch a football game. I watch a football game. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't just watch a football game. I watch a football game. Ron, what's wrong with you? Too much green tea? No, listen to me. Some people just watch a football game. I watch a football game. I look at everything and I analyze it to pieces to the point where it's not even interesting anymore. It's ironic. Everything's ironic. Here is a sport where the idea is to knock the other person down. Here's a ball which isn't even like a ball. It's oblong, and the guy, the leader of the team, throws the ball to another guy, which is about as immature and as childish as you can get. Hey, Bobby, I have a ball. Throw me the ball, Joe. Okay, Bobby. And then somebody on the other team goes, oh, you're not going to catch that ball. I'm going to knock it down. I'm going to cause death and destruction. I'm not only going to knock it down, the guy that wants to catch the ball, I'm going to knock the living shit out of this guy. I'm going to knock him to the ground to the point where he can't even get up. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a sport. It is a sport which not only condones but embraces violence like there's no tomorrow. As a matter of fact, the players of a football game have to wear padding, and they have to wear a helmet that can probably stop a bullet. You know, a helmet that a train could crash into your head, and the train would get hurt. You know, these helmets are made with polybucatine and fly them with a cleaner plastics, a polymer found only in outer space on Neptune. I mean, these helmets are incredible. And there are penalties for hurting players. You can't rough the receiver. Rough the receiver. I thought the idea of the game was to knock the guy down before he catches the ball. Yeah, but you can't rough him up. What? And they got all these rules when the idea of the game is to knock the other person off their feet big time, yet there's rules that you can't knock the other person off their feet big time. And then when you actually score a touchdown, ladies and gentlemen, the person that scored the touchdown actually celebrates by taking his head and banging it into the head of the other team, of their team members. Their own team members bang their helmets together in celebration. Smart move, smart move, smart move, smart, smart. You did something really well. To celebrate, I'm going to smash my head into your head. Okay, that sounds like fun. And in college football and high school football, if somebody scores a touchdown, their own team members actually gang pile on them. They actually jump onto a pile and they smother the guy that just scored the touchdown. Their own teammate, they jump on them in celebration. This is how they celebrate. They jump on you and they smash their head into you. It's a phenomenal game. It's a funny, funny, phenomenal game. I love it. I love it because it's stupid. It's just stupid. It's stupid. I used to really like watching hockey. I thought hockey was fun. It's like watching a couple of cats bat around a catnip mouse. It's just interesting. And you can never see the puck. Even if you're watching on TV or if you're sitting in the stands watching an ice hockey game, all you do is you see guys skating around, but you never see the puck. It's this tiny little black thing. It just, you can't even see it. So it's not even the point. The way you can tell where the puck is that's where all the hockey skaters seem to be at that particular moment. That's how you know the puck's there. There was a time, I'm old enough, when I used to watch hockey and they didn't wear helmets. They just skated around with their bare head, with their hair flying around. And yet it was the most violent game at the time because the idea of hockey was to knock the other person down, not on a soft green grass field like football, but on hard ice. You would knock them down, take your hockey stick, and beat the crap out of the guy. You would take off your hockey gloves, and you would take your fists and start throwing punches at the other guy who wasn't wearing a helmet. And the referees would just stand there, and they'd let you fight for about 30 seconds. And then if somebody lost a tooth or their nose started hanging from their face, then the refs would kind of come in. They'd go, your penalty, go sit over there, you little bad boy. Sit in the corner and face the wall. And then hockey progressed to the point where they figured, maybe this doesn't make sense. And they pretty much started voluntarily, you can wear a helmet. And now everybody wears a helmet in hockey because the idea of hockey is to beat the other guy over the head with your hockey stick. Prevent that person from getting to that puck at all costs. It seems that our sports have become incredibly acceptably violent. Even baseball, where most of the ball players look like most of the spectators. In other words, you could take a spectator out of the stands at a ballpark, put them in a baseball uniform, and they pretty much look like everybody else. Because the players actually have beer guts. They're stinky, dirty people who chew tobacco, spit it on the ground, walk around in mud. They're just disgusting people. They don't run onto the field. They walk with a little zip, not much. They walk on and they walk off. They don't even run anymore. I don't understand baseball at all. But even once in a while, if the pitcher hits the batter with a stray ball, then the dugout will clear out and they'll start fighting each other. Everything is so violent these days. And then we get into the MMA, the mixed martial arts, the MMA, which not only do you box the person, but you can kick him in the groin. You can actually kick them in all parts of their body, wrestle them to the ground. You can actually take their head and insert it into your crotch and hold them there. That's called the Marty. I don't know what it's called. It's a wrestling move. Take somebody's head and stick it up your crotch. I don't know. I think that's why gay marriage is so well accepted these days, and I'm not making a joke of it. I just think it's from MMA wrestling. It's just an odd sports world that we have. The only place that still has any type of civil respect is golf. The most boring game in the world. Its commentators are so bored, they sound like they're about to fall asleep. Sean O'Patrick, he's on the green. I think he's going to use a putter, and he's got he's laying about 5 feet from the cup, and he's walking over now very, very slowly and very, very deliberately. He's going to use a putter on. He's looking to perhaps tie up this championship by singing this into.
The Ron Van Dam Show is intended for mature audiences.
Oh, so that's what ironic means.
Yes, honey. Yes, it does.
others say that water is just water.
Aquamira.
Each bottle of Aquamira, all-natural, artisanal, gourmet lifestyle water,
Aquamira,
contains only the finest, hand-selected waters, gently and sustainably culled from free-range, certified glacial streams in fair trade countries.
Aquamira.
Skillfully aged in stainless steel, cruelty-free tanks, and quintuple filtered according to age-old Nepalese watersmithing techniques.
Aquamira.
Each non-GMO serving of Aquamira all-natural artisanal gourmet lifestyle water is allergen-free, safe for use on pets, and contains zero trans fats.
Aquamira.
Yes, let others say that water is just water. For the true discerning connoisseur, there is only one. There is only
Aquamira.
Find Aquamira water in handy 42 packs in the beverage section of your local convenience store, liquor store, or gas station. Free bottle with every purchase of a Take This Job and Shove It lottery scratch-off ticket while supplies last. Aquamira all-natural gourmet lifestyle water is bottled by the overarching Beverage Conglomeration Corporation, LLC.
Oh, man, huh? Gotta tell ya. I don't know what I'm gonna tell you, but I gotta tell ya. I saw a commercial last night for smoking, not smoking. You know, they have these Nicoderm patches and Fleshaderm, and now they have other drugs that you take, and it's supposed to make you feel like not smoking anymore. It takes the want and the urge to smoke, it takes it away. And I thought, you know, why are we fooling around with these little taking the urges away kind of medication? If you really want to stop smoking, why can't they come up with something, the pharmaceutical companies, why can't they go with something where every time you take a puff of a cigarette, you literally throw up immediately? You upchuck all over the floor, all over your car. If you're sitting in a social situation and you light up a cigarette, you will puke on somebody's sofa. The immediate reaction to having any type of smoke in your lungs whatsoever is to vomit. I'm sure that is inventable. It might be a little bit harsh for many people, but I think it would really, really, really work. I mean, no more of this. I'm taking this Nicoderm pill, whatever it's called, and no, I don't feel like smoking so much. No, you won't feel like smoking at all if you literally vomit every time you take a drag on a cigarette. That will stop you from smoking. That's what you call Pavlov's dog. Eventually, smoking won't make you feel like throwing up, but you definitely will not want a cigarette. Here's another idea. Why don't you take a cigarette butt from which you've just smoked and eat it? Yes, you have to eat the cigarette butt. You will indeed throw up immediately from that as well. But I guarantee you, if you start eating the stuff that you're smoking, you will definitely not smoke anymore. Now, that doesn't go for all drugs. Some people eat marijuana and they're perfectly happy with that. But I'm talking about something with the tar and the nicotine. You ingest that. Of course, you'll die, but then you won't smoke anymore. So I don't know. I think we're being a little too soft with this. It reduces the need, the want to smoke. Yeah, I'll give you something that'll reduce the want to smoke. And for those people that overeat, they take these little pills now that take your appetite away. They take your appetite. You're not hungry anymore. You're not hungry to have a lot of food anymore. And that's how. Now, how about a little pill where every time you eat a little too much, you vomit, you throw up? Let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. Vomit is probably the greatest deterrent to whatever you're doing. Vomit-induced things will always make you stop doing whatever you. Let's say you say I've been divorced 5 times. Please, don't ever let me marry anybody again. Marriage is horrible. I do not want to ever marry again. And then you find yourself to proposing to somebody again that you just fallen in love with. You take this little pill, and as you say, Cynthia, will you all over her. You throw up, vomit all over her. She won't marry you. You won't want to get married. Problem solved. There you go. You know, not only am I a talk show host, but I do solve the world problems quite easily. They're all quite solvable. Solvable. Speaking of that, let's speak about religion. Christ actually is a book, James Carroll. Let's raise him and speak to him. This is going to be fascinating stuff, kids. Hi, James. How are you?
Good morning. Is this Ron?
This is Ron. And this is James.
Hi, Ron.
How are you doing?
My privilege to be with you. Thanks so much.
You're very, very welcome. James Carroll is the author of Christ Actually, Reimagining Faith in the Modern Age. What made you get into the subject matter?
Ron, I'm of that age of folks who came into my maturity slowly but surely reckoning with the Holocaust.
Uh-huh.
And the Holocaust for me, which was, while it was a lethal, murderous action of Nazis, also laid bare the deep mistake that Christian faith had made down through the centuries, mm-hmm. in imagining the Jewish people as the enemy of God.
Right.
And that was a personal crisis for me.
Hmm.
I'm a Catholic.
I see.
My faith matters enormously to me. And the question came, is my faith somehow an encouragement to anti-Semitism, which was laid bare in the 20th century as the great crime of Western culture? And this book comes out of 20 or more years of, I would say, without embarrassment, a kind of prayerful reflection on the meaning of Jesus, starting with the fact that he's a Jew,
right,
permanently and completely Jewish.
Right.
Jesus was and is no Christian, and that's part of the revelation that I'm dealing with in this book.
Yeah, interesting. When you were, may I ask, in your childhood or in your young adulthood, was there some type of psychological influence on you that made you feel in this way?
Well, yes, there was, actually. My dad was in the United States Air Force, and when I was a teenager, we were stationed in Germany, and that was the beginning of a kind of awakening for me, because every German I met, and I made a point to meet a lot, and I played soccer with German kids, and everybody hated Hitler.
Yeah.
And from the impression I took in the 1950s was that the Holocaust was the work of a small group of crazy Nazis, but the German folks were appalled by it and innocent of it.
Right.
And you know what? That's just not the case. The Nazis could not have done what they did without the active complicity, or at least the passive neutrality, of a whole culture, including the church, Protestant and Catholic alike. And as I grew up, this became more and more a problem for me.
Yeah.
And here's a basic question. You know, there should be 200 or 300 million Jews living on the planet today. If you just extrapolate from the number of Jews who lived in the ancient Roman world, Jews and Christians started out equivalent populations. Why are there only 15 million Jews alive on the planet Earth now, instead of 200 or 300 million? And the answer is 2,000 years of Christian anti-Judaism, which morphed into anti-Semitism. That's a huge challenge to the faith of a Christian.
To some
and
extent.
And I have done this work trying to preserve my faith, actually, and that's why I wrote Christ Actually.
I mean, would not the large number of Jewish population be more toward the point that they're not Catholic and they don't have 10 children, and that many of them have gone to the reform end of the Jewish religion, etc.
Those are factors. Those are factors, Ron, to take into account, I suppose. I'm not a demographer. I have to acknowledge that. Right. But just the scale of difference, there are more than 1 billion Catholics alive on the planet today. There are more than 1.5 billion Christians.
True.
Compared to somewhere between 13 and 15 million Jews. There's a demographic gap there, and it puts a basic question. Why is that? And the answer is that down through the centuries, Jews were restricted. Sometimes they were actually targeted and killed.
Right.
They have been, without falling into the trap of thinking of them as a perennial victim people, they have been at the mercy of something that was very respectable in Christianity, not just gutter anti-Semitism, but religious anti-Judaism. The idea that, quote, the Jews killed Christ, unquote, was a lethal tradition that led, in Holy Week especially, year in and year out, to Jews being harassed and sometimes attacked. So, really, my basic point in this book is to look at the Gospels again, unpack the Gospels, understand how they came to be written, because the Gospels do tell a story of Jesus against, quote, the Jews, unquote. Right. How did that happen? Was Jesus, quote, against the Jews, quote? No, he wasn't. He was a Jew. And the people who loved him and who followed him were all Jews.
Yeah.
And it was... it's crucial to recover that memory. If we Christians hadn't forgotten that, the history of these last 2,000 years would be very different.
You know, I think most people know that Christ, that Jesus was a Jew, but they don't go any further with that process. They don't look at,
what does that mean?
That
going further is exactly what... Yeah. That going further is what's needed.
Yeah. I mean, you made a good point that... you're talking about the gospel and the story of Jesus. It is a story. Do we blame members of society for being brainwashed for, and this is true of many religions and true of Nazi Germany, they were brainwashed. They were told to believe a certain way, and they bought it. A lot of people support Donald Trump. I don't know why I went there, but I'm just, as an example of of people following.
Yeah, brainwashing suggests that there was somebody doing it, and I think that the history is more complicated than that. It unfolded over the centuries. The beginning of the conflict between what you might call the Jesus people and the rabbis, who were the Jews, actually began in the thick of a brutal war, the Roman war against the Jews, which was a kind of first Holocaust. The Romans killed a couple of million Jews, scholars tell us, in a three-phased war in the decades after the death of Jesus. And in the thick of that war, as often happens, a civil war broke out among the Jewish people. And that civil war basically boiled down to an argument between Jews who accepted Jesus as the Messiah and Jews who did not.
Yeah.
And because of the pressures of the Roman War, the first Holocaust, that civil war between Jews became polemical. And the polemic is caught in the Gospels. That set in motion a what you might call a misremembering of Jesus that grew more and more acute down through the centuries. So, in effect, the brainwashing was a consequence of a brutal outbreak of, you might say, genocidal violence in the beginning of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The brainwashing, if we can call it that, basically corrupted the Christian imagination.
Uh-huh.
And that corruption is what was laid bare during the Holocaust. And we Christians have not finished our reckoning with it. It also opens us into some great modern questions, which is, what do we Christians mean anyway when we talk about God?
Right.
And in the scientific age, does Christian faith get undercut by scientific thinking and so forth? The modern problems of religious belief, that's the subject I'm taking up in this book, actually.
Very interesting. I mean, you're right. I mean, every day
that's a bit of a fire hose, Ron. Forgive me for aiming it at you like that. But
no,
I've got some buttons pushed here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the idea of any good piece, is to push buttons and make you think beyond where you would have been before. And your book does that. It's called Christ Actually, Reimagining Faith in the Modern Age. I think I could talk to you for hours here and supply you with people that could talk to you for hours more, but we're going to have to read the book. It's fascinating. It's available everywhere, I assume. You've had great accolades in reviews here.
Well, you've honored me by having me in this conversation, Ron. I appreciate it.
How can we follow James Carroll? Is there a website or something?
Well, you can go to my website, jamescarroll.net.
There you go.
And I'm privileged to be in touch with my readers. I value readers enormously, and I value folks like you who put me in touch with them.
Cool.
So thanks a million.
Well, I always value people that actually put something out there and make your brain work a little bit more than it's used to, besides watching sports and drinking beer. So that's just very cool.
Yeah.
James, it's been a real pleasure. I thank you for your time today.
All the best to you, Rob.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
thank you to James Carroll for joining us today with his book, Christ Actually. And thank you to you for joining us. And thank you to my cohorts, Nicola, who does that opening sequence for us, the British Babe, and John Shanahan, who is the master of our comedy commercials and our little introduction things, and all of you, and Tori Lagarde, who joins us once a week for interesting back-and-forth male-female conversation. She would be the female, I would be the male, just so you don't get confused about that part. And the others that contribute to this program to make it what it is, whatever it is the question. But right now, ladies and gentlemen, I have extended my welcome beyond all expectations, and I wish you peace. Be with me tomorrow, if you would, please, and continue our long-lasting love relationship of comedy, good fellowship, as I spread the word of whatever I'm spreading. I don't know what I'm spreading, but it's being spread. I think you know what I'm spreading. It's the kind of things you'll find where they have cows in a barn. I spread that stuff. You know what? Ask you is, was this show informative? Was it intuitive? Was it relaxing?
It was unbelievably painful.
Whatever.